supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, we've all experienced vulnerability, and I think I can safely say we all hate it. And because of that, when we experience it, most of us run, feel embarrassed, maybe we freeze up, withdraw. Inevitably, we hide. We hide our vulnerability. We put on our mask and we march forward. Like a CEO friend of mine said, if his company knew about his anxiety, even his physical vulnerability, he'd have to leave his job. My guest, research professor and author Brené Brown, says, hold on there, vulnerability is not a weakness, and it's actually the key to truly intimate, honest, healthy relationships. Here she is in a recent TED Talk.
There's a great quote that saved me this past year by Theodore Roosevelt. A lot of people refer to it as the man in the arena quote. And it goes like this. It is not the critic who counts. It is not the man who sits and points out how the doer of deeds could have done things better and how he falls and stumbles. The credit goes to the man in the arena, whose face is marred with dust and blood and sweat. But when he's in the arena, at best, he wins, and at worst, he loses. But when he fails, when he loses, he does so daring greatly. That's what life is about daring greatly, about being in the arena. When you walk up to that arena and you put your hand on the door and you think, I'm going in and I'm going to try this, shame is the gremlin who says, you're not good enough. You never finished that MBA. Your wife left you. I know your dad really wasn't in Luxembourg, he was in Sing Sing. Shame is that thing. And then if we can quiet it down and walk in and say, I'm going to do this, we look up and the critic that we see pointing and laughing 99% of the time is who? Us.
That's my guest, Brené Brown. She's a research professor at the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work. And she spent the last decade studying vulnerability, courage, worthiness, and shame. Her new book is called Daring Greatly, How the Courage to be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. She joins me by phone from Texas. Brené, welcome back.
Oh, I'm happy to be back with y'all.
Yeah, me too. We know you're from Texas. Happy to be back with you all.
Sorry. right out of the chute, right?
Yeah. We'd love to take your phone calls. We're at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If any of you, and I know all of you, have experienced vulnerability, what do you do when it happens? How do you experience it? Give us a call. We'd love to talk about it and talk about what it means and what to do about it. So let's start with that phrase that you talked about, daring greatly, and where it comes from. Tell us what those two words mean to you.
I am just so smitten with that phrase. I think it's been so transformative for me personally. And it just, you know, when I read that quote, I thought, you know, this is everything I've ever learned about vulnerability summed up in this very poetic quote from Teddy Roosevelt, that vulnerability is not about winning. It's not about losing. It's about showing up and being seen. And I just loved that. And I love the fact that, you know, in this culture that I often describe as, you know, reflexive cynicism and projectile criticism, that to show up and let ourselves be seen, to put our ideas on the table, to raise our hand at a meeting, to say I love you first, that these are all tremendously brave things. And they, to me, that is daring greatly.
Well, I've got to tell you, we're going to try to get a better line for you. Hang up. We'll get right back to you. But and by the way, our number is 888-477-9499. I'm really interested in what happens to you when you feel vulnerable. We're going to talk about how I believe that vulnerability intolerance is really, really in our DNA. And, you know, like most kids, I spent much of my childhood feeling not good enough, feeling vulnerable, that if I was known, then I would be rejected. Brene, we have you back? We have you back yet? Well, we'll try again. But, you know, then after, you know, my childhood, I pretended I wasn't vulnerable. I pretended, you know, I was like the other kids. And, of course, that didn't work. And even in my youth, after I got out of graduate school and became a psychologist, I told myself, if I worked hard enough, if I pushed myself hard enough, if I had a beautiful wife and a nice home and beautiful kids, then I'd be good enough. And I had all those things, and I still wasn't. And, you know, here I am in my career. I've been counseling people for 40 years, and I'm not alone. I mean, I see it professionally, I see it personally, I see it wherever I go, that people are pushing themselves and pushing their children and achieving so much in the secret, often not conscious, hopes that if they do that, then finally they'll be okay, they'll be lovable, they'll be acceptable to their community. Brene, do we have you? Well, we're having a problem with the line, and we're going to be patient because I know we're going to get her back. But meanwhile,
hello.
Oh, there.
Hi.
There's my old friend from Texas.
I'm here.
It's
we're going to make it work if we have to do soup cans and string.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, honey, I covered everything in the 5 minutes you were gone.
So awesome.
I've answered all the questions. You and I can just hang out now.
That's great.
I want you to put on your semi-academic hat for a minute.
Sure.
So, like I said, and I talked about my own experience of, you know, my youth not being good enough and what I did to compensate for it, and it didn't work out very well. But, you know, all of us have experienced vulnerability, but I wonder if it feels different to different humans. What actually is this phenomenon called vulnerability? Is there a way to describe it, understand it?
I think there is, and it's the foundational question, really.
Yeah.
You know, 11,000 pieces of data, you know, just interview after interview. I'm a qualitative researcher, so I do long interviews or focus groups. And, you know, we had this huge kind of understanding of, but what does vulnerability share in common? What are the themes and patterns that are emerging from the data? And really what emerged was a fairly simple definition of vulnerability, which is it's uncertainty, it's risk, and it's emotional exposure. And so when we asked people, what is vulnerability, they gave us all kinds of, you know, really diverse answers. They would say, asking for help, starting my own business, helping my 37-year-old wife with stage 4 breast cancer make decisions about her will, initiating sex with my wife, initiating sex with my husband, hearing how much my son wants to make the first chair in the orchestra and encouraging him and cheering him on, but knowing that that's probably not going to happen. Calling a friend who has just been through a tragedy. You know, they are the moments that define our lives. And so I think vulnerability are those moments where we don't have control.
So calling a friend who's ill or cheering on a son, knowing that there's a good chance he won't achieve what he's trying to achieve. Help me understand how that's vulnerability.
Well, I can definitely speak to the parenting one because we're kind of in the middle of that right now. Right. But I just, you know, sending my kids to school, knowing that they're really trying something and they want to succeed, and knowing that the chances are probably pretty great that they're not going to accomplish what they want to, but the experience is so valuable and so important. You know, I face that often as a parent. And, you know, I think there are a lot of parents who, when we can't tolerate the vulnerability, what we're likely to say is, hey, sweetie, I really don't think you should try out for the volleyball team. There's, you know, a lot of kids, girls a lot better than you are who've been playing a lot longer, and it'll be very hard if you don't make it. So let's do something else instead. As opposed to, not only am I cheering you on, I just want you to know how amazing I think it is that you're letting people know that this is exciting and important to you, even though there's a lot of risk involved. And so I think sometimes, as a parent, standing back and letting our children walk into that arena, even when there are no guarantees, is not only vulnerable for our kids, but it's incredibly vulnerable for us.
The psychoanalyst Sheldon Kopp said that the most difficult part of love is tolerating our helplessness in the face of a loved one suffering or risk taking, or, you know, it's about tolerating our own helplessness and not being reactive to it.
There's no question about it, because there's no question about it, even if it's my husband Steve that's trying something, you know, it's
right.
You know, his first triathlon, and he's like, I don't know, you think I should do it? I'm like, what I wanted to say inside is, don't do it, it sounds dangerous, and I don't know. But you know what I said is, I think you're awesome for getting out there and doing it, and no one's, your first anything can't be good. But, you know, one of the things I think happens is, I think as adults, a lot of us hit midlife and start thinking, oh my God, I'm not trying anything new because I won't do anything that I'm not already good at doing.
Well, yeah, that's problematic. You know, Brene, I said to the audience before, when we're fumbling with your phone lines, that I believe our fear of vulnerability is in our DNA. You know, animals in the wild who are vulnerable are left to die or be eaten. So I wonder, you know, vulnerability doesn't feel good for a reason.
I think that's true. And I do think that's true. But I think if you look at issues like shame and vulnerability from an evolutionary biological perspective, I think you'll see that maybe they served a purpose somewhere along the way. But I don't think now that our ability to understand emotion in ourselves and in each other has grown so exponentially that, you know, I don't think we would have half of the wonderful things we have today without someone really risking vulnerability, because I can't find a single example of moral courage, leadership courage, or innovation that is not completely born of vulnerability. You know, when I interview CEOs and people who are considered disruptive innovators in their fields, you know, I always ask them, you know, what does it take to be a disruptive innovator? What does it take to be a good leader? And the answer is always vulnerability, the ability to tolerate it, to hold space for it, to stand in it, to lead through it.
To tolerate being different. To tolerate being exposed. Yeah, so many of us, we're also hardwired for relationships. And I mean, I know that's a central theme of your research, that, you know, whether we live or die emotionally is all about our relationships, how many of them we have and the quality of them.
I agree 100%. And I think I would argue that vulnerability is probably the glue that binds relationships. I want to be seen. I want to be known by the people I'm, you know, with whom I'm in relationship. I want to see and fully know the people that, you know, who I love. And I think that is really risky. And I think it's very easy in this kind of culture of perfectionism to hustle in our relationships and kind of be who we think we're supposed to be. Yeah. And minimize vulnerability because we're minimizing hurt.
Well, being seen is a quantitative statement and not a qualitative one. I want to tell you an experience I had.
Sure.
About a month ago. Now, you may remember I'm a quadriplegic, and I know a good deal about vulnerability, being vulnerable and not being able to hide it. So I was at this play here in Philadelphia called Food Court. It was an Australian play by Back-to-Back Theater, and the play was ostensibly about discrimination for people with intellectual disabilities, and all of the actors, there's about five actors, had intellectual disabilities. And
wow.
This woman with cerebral palsy played an actor, someone who was mute. And the other two actors who had intellectual disabilities just berated her, called her horrible names and stupid. And then they took her into the woods behind this hazy, translucent curtain. They took her out in the woods and they told her to take her clothes off. And she did. And everybody in the audience was uncomfortable. And then they told her to take her underwear off. And I was screaming for her not to do it inside. And she did. And there she was, completely naked. And they humiliated her. And they kicked her and beat her and left her and walked away. And I said, after the play, I was one of the discussants, I said, that's not about discrimination or intellectual disabilities. I said, that's the human fear, that we will be completely naked like that and exposed and ultimately rejected and walked away and left alone. I think that's a universal fear, Brene.
Oh, God, there's no question. I can barely swallow.
Yeah.
I do think, I mean, obviously that's a horrific, graphic extreme, but I think that is the analogy. That is the fear. That is shame, that something about us is unlovable. And I think, you know, what makes daring greatly so difficult, you know, people, you know, there's a chapter in Daring Greatly, you know, and right underneath the chapter heading, I say, yes, we have to talk about shame and vulnerability in the same book. You know, you'll make it through. Because I don't think you can talk about vulnerability and daring without talking about shame. Because, you know, I know that you played that piece from the 2012 TED Talk, but I think the thing that keeps us from showing up, the thing that keeps us from saying I love you first, the fear is that we're unlovable, that we're not worthy of love and belonging. And I think we are absolutely, as you pointed out earlier, hardwired for that. And so it's so hard to, you know, to use the metaphor of the arena from Roosevelt's quote, it's so hard to walk into the arena when we're so afraid and paralyzed by what people might see. Like, I don't want to go in and share this idea or say I love you first, because what if what comes back at me is the emotional equivalent of what you just described?
often we've got to take a break, and we've got lots and lots of phone calls. But I do want to mention this before we take our break.
Yeah.
You talk about the courage to walk into the arena, whether it's a big arena, whether it's in an interpersonal relationship. Often that arena is the mirror.
No question.
Literally and metaphorically, but literally looking
in
the mirror.
No question.
Let's talk about all that stuff in just 60 seconds, okay?
Can't wait. If
you're just tuning in, we're talking about who has become a dear friend of the show, Brené Brown. She's a professor at the University of Houston Graduate College, and she studies shame, vulnerability, courage, and that's what we're going to be talking about in the second part of our show. Do we have the courage to be who we are, to open up our vulnerability in interpersonal relationships or even to ourselves? I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane, host of Radio Times. Thank you so much for making a pledge of support during our fall membership campaign here at WHYY. We asked and you responded. In fact, the response from listeners just like you has been generous and enthusiastic, and we really appreciate it. We will invest your money in the programs that you rely on to keep you informed about all the important issues that face us all, and we'll keep you entertained as well. So thanks again for all that you do to keep WHYY strong.
If we're going to find our way back to each other, we have to understand and know empathy, because empathy is the antidote to shame.
We're back on Voices in the Family with Brené Brown. Her new book is called Daring Greatly: How the Courage to Be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. So Let's go right to the phones, Brené. We've got Susan on the line.
Great.
Hi, Susan.
Thank you for taking my call. I think sometimes people like to be vulnerable, like people who tell their sad story or how bad they are at things. And I almost feel sometimes I fall into this category. I'm a leader in my organization, but I like to share my uncertainty sometimes when making a decision, or talk a little bit about my family and home life and struggles, just to make myself more human and to help people empathize a little bit with what I'm going through. And yet I think people also want a strong leader, so it sometimes turns them off, and I sometimes have a hard time finding the right balance. So I'd like to hear your reflections on that.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I wanted to talk about that also with our leaders. So what's your reaction to that, Brené?
I think it's a great question, and I would like to work for you. I mean, I really appreciate that kind of vulnerability and transparency in leaders. And I think that we're moving more and more toward a recognition of that. Now, in the beginning of the call, when you said there are people who kind of share their sad stories, and one thing that, I have a chapter called The Myth of Vulnerability, and there are four big myths I address. The first one is that vulnerability is weakness. The second one is that we can opt out of vulnerability, that we can actually, just say, well, I don't do it, because to be alive is to be vulnerable. And the third one is that vulnerability is letting it all hang out. And, I think as not just leaders, but as people in our lives, we have to stay very aware of boundaries and roles and expectations when we're sharing vulnerability. For example, one of the things that I was not expecting to find when I specifically interviewed leaders about vulnerability is that there was an amount of vulnerability that they shared with the people who worked for them and with them. But there was a whole nother level of vulnerability they shared with peer groups. And every, you know, almost every person I interviewed who had risen kind of to the top of their ranks talked about the importance of having a peer group outside of their organization where they could really share more openly. They could say things like, God, this big change is coming down, you know, right now, and I feel so out of control, and I feel fearful that I'm not taking things in the right direction. I'm not sure what to do about this, you know, and on top of everything, I had a questionable mammogram, and I'm just feeling, you know, those are things that, you know, that vulnerability is so important, and it's those conversations that come from that are so important. Do I say that to the people who report directly to me, who are in the midst of change and afraid? No, what I might say to them is, this is scary. This is hard for all of us. I can't do this alone without your input. I can't move us in the right direction during this change without all hands on deck. I need all of you. I don't have all the answers. That's why I brought you all, you know, that's why you work here, because I'm depending on you for them too. That, again, is still vulnerability, but it's acknowledging boundaries and roles. And I think that's super important as we talk about vulnerability.
Brené, I'm going to tell you a teaching story that I was fortunate enough to bear witness to. And I've told this story on the air a couple of times, that I was in a hospital lobby and a woman was coming out of what was obviously the chemotherapy wing of the hospital, and she was wearing a turban and looked pretty fragile. And she had her little boy with her son, looked to be about 4 years old, and they were approaching this big revolving door. And the boy looked at the door and said to his mother, Mommy, I'm scared about the door. And she looked down at him and said, you know, honey, I'm a little scared too, but we'll hold hands and go through it together.
I love that. And I think that's absolutely, you know, I think that's the sentiment, that's power, that's the courage of vulnerability. Because in that moment, she's validating his fears. She's building connection, and she's normalizing that, look, someone that you know is brave and strong and can take care of you also gets afraid too. And so, I mean, to me, that's what it's about. But I do appreciate the dilemma of where are the lines and where are the boundaries about what we share. So in that story, you know, for my kids, if they approach, like, for example, we're looking for high schools right now for my daughter, which is unbelievable in itself because I still think of her as five. And I remember making a really kind of, if I went back and looked at, you know, this whole process through middle school, I remember sitting with her and her saying, I'm scared to leave. You know, we had this great neighborhood elementary school. I'm scared. And I was like, I'm scared too. I don't know what it's going to be like either. And she goes, and I'm confused about where I should go. And I was like, I have no idea either. And, you know, it's just, it feels like the stakes are, you know, and what I didn't do in that moment is say, you know what, I'm a little bit nervous about all this too, but we're going to do it together and we're going to find something that really feels like a great fit for all of us. I jumped into that thing with her, and that was not my role because it scared her even more. You know, and so that was a conversation for me to have maybe with my husband to say, oh my God, what are we going to do? And, you know, what about this and that? You know, but with her, it was still vulnerability. It was like, I don't have the answers either, but I have complete confidence in our ability to do this together and find the right choice for all of us.
Let's take another call. We've got Kelly on the line. Hey, Kelly.
Hi, Brené. I just wanted to say I watch your TED Talk at least once a week. become a really important tool for me in helping myself stay aware of being real. And what I'm discovering is that I don't have to sort of become this performative on big personality, that I can just sort of be my real authentic self and people really respond to me positively in that way. So I just want to thank you for, you know, helping me sort of providing a tool to know that, you know, daring greatly and being vulnerable is okay.
I love that. Thank you so much. And, you know, I love the way, I love that you said you listen to it weekly, because I think a lot of people, and you're making this point so wonderfully, a lot of people think this is like a one-time deal, like that you think about this, that you reflect on it, and then you check it off the list. Like, you know, for me, kind of like you, it's a practice. It's something I have to check in around every, sometimes several times during one day if I'm up against really hard stuff. You know, it's something that I think practicing authenticity, I think daring greatly, you know, really understanding the shame gremlins and detangling them is not something, it's not a check-off item on a to-do list. It's a way of living. It's a practice. And I do think tools are really helpful. And so I really appreciate you bringing up this kind of, this is something you're doing over and over, because that is definitely my experience and my story.
Kelly, thanks so much. And Brenea, you know, you talk about a practice, and Kelly listens to your TED Talks weekly, which I think is a pretty good idea. But when you say practice, daring greatly, having comfort, more comfort with your own vulnerability, can become habitual with practice. It can become a habit with practice. I know, you know, when I first started doing this radio show, I was in the depths of a depression following my accident that put me in the wheelchair, a pretty severe clinical depression. And, you know, I was afraid if, you know, they knew I was in a wheelchair, my audience would reject me. But slowly but surely, over the months and years, like the more I've exposed, the more connected I feel with the audience and vice versa. And now, you know, my business card doesn't say anything. It doesn't say psychologist or any of my other titles. It just says Daniel Gottlieb Human. Because
I love it so much. No, it's true. And, you know, again, just a beautiful point, which is why I love talking to you. It's just, you know, I think one of the big, what's the word I'm looking for, paradoxes, I guess, of vulnerability is it's the first thing I look for in you and the last thing I want to show you in me. You know, in you, when you're vulnerable, I see strength and courage. When I think about being vulnerable, I think about being weak. And I do think that if we practice it enough and we stay mindful, that it can become a habit. That, and not only can it become a habit, and I'd be curious about your experience of this, I think we develop a healthy intolerance for hustling. Like, the more I practice daring greatly, and by daring greatly, I don't mean like, you know, jumping out of planes, and, you know, I mean something way more difficult than that. I mean that, when, you know, rather than starting a cold war with my husband, which I'm really excellent at doing, I walk in the room and say, this really hurt my feelings. To me, that's daring greatly. To me, that's opening myself up and saying, being vulnerable, you know. So I think when you do that enough and you see the connection that is a product of that courage, that hustling for our worthiness and pretending and performing and pleasing become really, really exhausting. Like, I can't do it very well anymore. Much to people's detriment, maybe.
Well, you know, at my age, I don't have the strength. But, you know, to play those games. But I do have to tell you, I talk a good deal at my talks about an open heart. And, you know, it's where that open heart, where we're the most vulnerable, we're the most loving, where we can feel and give love. It's also where we're at the most risk. It's where we're tender, right there. But, you know, somebody pointed out to me, a doctor once said, but the biological heart opens and closes all day. You would, you know, you can't leave it open. You would die. And I thought about it, and I thought, so too the metaphorical heart. You know, that it can't stay open. It closes during the course of the day. Like you said, when we're leading, you know, we can't keep it that wide open. But what I would ask of myself mostly is just to be aware when the heart's open and when it's closed. And then you can be more present to your life, because it is going to be closed throughout the day. Just be aware of when it's open and closed. And that's the challenge. That's a challenge for me, and that's what I wish for everybody I know and love.
I agree. I think that's why I think we're very similar in that way. I talk about wholeheartedness. And,
yeah,
you know, I think that's kind of what, that's the name I've given to the folks who, in my research, who I saw really kind of living and loving with their whole hearts, who are really all in. And those are the people I write about in Daring Greatly and The Gift of Imperfection, because I wanted to know what they had in common, and vulnerability and worthiness were the two greatest things they had in common.
Well, when we come back from our break, I want to talk about how we make that transition from feeling unworthy to worthy, how we can fix that little problem. We're talking with Brené Brown. She's a research professor who spent the last decade studying just what we're talking about, which is vulnerability and vulnerability tolerance. We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-672-4900. That's 215-672-4900. Drexel supports WHYY.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation works to advance economic opportunity in southeastern Pennsylvania. It helps strengthen nonprofits that develop workplace skills, teach financial literacy, help new arrivals, and sustain those undergoing tough times. The Foundation can help you make a difference for such nonprofits today and forever. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
If you put shame in a petri dish, it needs three things to grow exponentially: secrecy, silence, and judgment. If you put the same amount of shame in a petri dish and douse it with empathy, it can't survive.
We are back on Voices in the Family with Brené Brown. So you put empathy in that petri dish. Easier said than done.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been a very helpful metaphor for me, because if you have shame in a petri dish, and it just needs three things to kind of grow exponentially into every corner and crevice of our lives, and that's judgment, secrecy, and silence. And if you have the same amount of shame in a petri dish, and rather than, you know, feeding it with secrecy and silence and judgment, you kind of douse it with empathy, you've created an environment that's hostile for empathy, for shame. You know, empathy really heals shame, which makes sense because shame is a very social construct. It happens to, between people, therefore it heals between people. So it makes sense to me how that works.
In order to get there, somehow we've got to make a relationship with a critical self-judge.
We do. We have to... Yeah, so when I experience shame, I have my three things. My first thing is recognize that I'm in it. Number two, talk to myself like I talk to someone I love. And number three is reach out to someone on my very short list of people and tell my story. because shame just can't survive being spoken, you know, which is a part of the empathy.
Yes, yeah. I mean, talk about the Petri dish. Sunlight really does, you know, kill shame.
It does. And so, you know, if I were to call you and say, hey, it's Brené, and you're not going to believe what happened, I'm just in the shame spiral, do you have a minute? And I told you what happened, and you responded with empathy, not sympathy, not I feel sorry for you, but, you know, not, you know, sympathy is I feel for you, but empathy, I feel with you. Oh, man, Brené, I get that. I get that in my bones. I've been there. That just sucks.
My job as I listen to you is to have the courage to allow my heart to open to feel your experience and not to react to it.
That's it.
That's courage.
That's courage and vulnerability.
My job is as hard as yours.
There's no question. And it's a vulnerable endeavor. You know, empathy is not the default response when someone is in struggle. It is a mindful choice to be courageous, to be with someone. You know, Pema Chodron, who she talks about compassion in such a beautiful, powerful way. She has a quote that says, compassion is knowing our darkness well enough that we can sit in the dark with others. It's not a relationship between the wounded and the healed. It's a relationship between equals.
Hmm. Well, I've got to tell you something I talk about often when I when I talk to doctors and therapists. I said that Hippocrates said that inside of every patient there's a doctor that can heal them. Well, Gottlieb says inside of every doctor there's a vulnerable patient, and unless all four of them are in the room, there's a lie going on in there.
Oh, that's so true. I'm thinking about my husband, who's a physician, he's a pediatrician, and a lot of the, you know, parents talk to me all the time, and they say, yeah, he listens, and he talks about his own experiences as a father and how scary it can be.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, yeah. If we can just own our own woundedness. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Ron on the line. Ron?
Hi, Brené.
Hi.
I just want to say your research has changed my life, and I want to thank you for opening this dialogue up to the world. I got to meet you out in Colorado at your workshop this spring, and I've actually given a couple workshops where we just listen to your TED Talk and then talk for an hour with like 40 people in the room, and it's talk about people really bearing their souls. It's been beautiful.
Oh.
My question for you, though, on those days where you just have these negative feelings, these sadness, insecurities, or whatever, you know, instead of numbing out and sort of feeling your feelings, like, how do we build a relationship with those emotions that are just so deep and, you know, without letting them take over and, you know, take over the bus?
You know, I think that is a really powerful question, and I'm laughing because I'm in the middle of trying to understand that in my own life. And I think for me, I'm trying a new approach. Rather than when sadness, I feel sad, or disappointed, or I'm struggling with some grief about something, my normal reaction is to push away. And to push it away, and numbing is certainly something, you know, it's one of those things where you just find yourself in the pantry and you don't know how you got there. One of the things I'm really trying is I'm really trying to journal and write, and with the idea of inviting those feelings to come over for a cup of coffee, just to befriend them, you know, because I think, you know, if we use shame as an example, there are some people, there are some therapists and some researchers who say, you know, if shame comes or sadness comes, you look it in the face and you say, you know, metaphorically, I guess, go away. Get out of my life. I don't need you. I don't want you. And my experience
as a researcher and talking to people about that approach is that, you know, these emotions can respond like a frustrated toddler. And if you've ever, you know, if anyone's ever has ever raised a toddler, when you get frustrated and tell them to start going away or sit down, they just stand up and start screaming louder. And so to me, it's a little bit of the self-compassion. One of the things I would recommend that you might really like and maybe even could incorporate into your workshop is Kristen Neff is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and she is a wonderful self-compassion researcher. And if you go to her website, she has a website called selfcompassionlab.org. And if you go there, you can take a self-compassion test. And she divides it into three pieces, self-kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness. And I took that quiz online, and it's really helped me because what I realized is that I'm very good at common humanity, I think because of my work. Like, I know when I'm sad or in struggle or ashamed or in grief that I'm not the only one because of the nature, you know, by nature of the work I do. I know we all have those feelings. I am not so great at mindfulness, and I really need some work on self-kindness. And so one of the things I'm really trying to do is take that information and write about it and talk to myself like I would talk to someone I love. I often picture my kids. If Ellen was sad or in grief or in real disappointment, would I say, come on, get up, let's go for a run? No, I'd say, hey, feel it. Be in it. Take care of yourself.
I would.
Take some time off. Explore what's going on.
I think that's wonderful, and I think right on, Ron. I would add a couple of other things. That your fear of sadness taking over, I want you to know that I have been there. I have felt those overwhelming emotions that I was afraid of. They never take over. They never ever take over. My fear that I would never stop crying once I started, I stopped crying. My fear that I would be humiliated for the rest of my life, it's about fear. It's not about humiliation. It's about fear of emotion. And all of this work, all of our work, all relationships, love, it's really a leap of faith. It's really a leap of faith. That ultimately, we need to have faith in our own spirits, that there's something inside that won't let us drown, that we can survive even the most frightening feelings, because when you look back over your life, you already have. And I think real freedom is when you're no longer afraid of yourself. And you know, and I couldn't agree more with Brené. Hold your own hand. Look in the mirror. Look deeply in your eyes when you look in the mirror. Smile and hold your hand and go through it. Ron, thanks so much. Thanks so much for your phone call, and it brings up some important issues. Brené, we've got time for one more call, and I think we've got somebody with a different point of view. Liz, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I really enjoyed this conversation and feel I want to sort of celebrate those around us who are not always vulnerable. I've selected a lifestyle and a job and a purpose in life that puts me in a very vulnerable position on a daily basis. And I am very fortunate to be married to a man who never reveals his vulnerability when we have serious, you know, real-life concerns. And I think that he does a great tribute to me in kind of keeping the steady force and the steady hand for us, knowing that, you know, his wife has selected a lifestyle that puts her in a very vulnerable position regularly, and that there is that need to have the yin and the yang. You've talked about, you know, love for yourself, and I feel like this is a very generous thing that he does for our family by allowing one of us to be out there and vulnerable and, you know, to keep the steady hand. So I just think we should celebrate some of that as well.
Yeah, I that's really a good point, Brené.
Yeah, No, I mean, and I think vulnerability also takes a different shape. I have a very vulnerable career, and I have a husband who is more, his vulnerability looks different than my vulnerability. And I think it comes in different packages. And I think that your point is so important, because it's almost like intimacy or anything that we revere and think is important, or connection. If we have in our mind one way that can be done and one way that's supposed to look, then I think that we discount it in other people. I think, you know, to me, someone who sits across, you know, while Steve is not, you know, probably doesn't do what I do, and is not vulnerable, doesn't express his vulnerability like I am, but when we're in deep conversation about something going on in our family, he's incredibly present. He's open to different ideas. And to me, that is also the definition of vulnerability. There are a lot of people who don't sit down and have any of those conversations in their partnerships. And so I think vulnerability can look and feel different for different people. But I think all of us are up against it. All of us are up against uncertainty, exposure, risk, because none of us live in a certain world. And I think it's becoming even more and more the case. So I do think we have to move away from one idea of vulnerability has to look and sound and feel a certain way in order for it to be valid. I think there are people who show up and are present and engaged with deep purpose and deep meaning, and their vulnerability looks very different than ours.
Brene, I think that is a perfect note to end on, although I'd love you hanging around. Listen, next time we have you on the show, you're just going to have to come down here and spend a couple weeks. We'll have all Brene all the time.
I love it.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brene. It's been wonderful. Brene Brown's new book is called Daring Greatly, How We Have the Courage to Be Vulnerable, Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. And please look her up on the TED Talks. Next week, we're going to be looking at who we are in the autumn years of our lives. Hey, listen, I've got two lectures coming up this week, one on this topic. It's called Parenting from the Heart, and the other I'm going to be talking with the author of Monkey Mind. It's on my webpage. Look it up. Well, you can comment on today's show by going to whyy.org/voices, or you can download our shows there or on iTunes. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Joshua Rafeman is our intern. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.